Hi everyone, my name is Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
Welcome to our podcast, The Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see a lot at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. The other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only 3 beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars. We could really use the help. You can leave a comment about absolutely anything, too. That small act of kindness will really help us expand our audience and continue to create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
Before we get started here, though, I want to tell you about our new monthly guidebook / workbook called The Motivated Musician. It's geared towards serious musicians, and it offers challenges, exercises, professional advice, and more to help keep your career and your musical life on track. Also, as an extra perk, members get exclusive discounts from MyMusicMasterclass.com. So if you want to learn more, go to MyMusicMasterclass.com and you'll see the subscribe link in the menu. Click that and you'll be good to go. All right, today we are here with an old friend and wonderfully talented musician, Jeremy Manasia. And Jeremy, if you don't know him, he's a great pianist. He's a native New Yorker. I believe he went to LaGuardia High School of the Arts. And he's got a bunch of solo records out. He's played with a ton of other people as well. I think Javon Jackson and Peter Bernstein and Lewis Hayes and, I don't know, Jimmy Cobb and all the cats. And he's got a lot of great philosophies as well. He's been doing Zen Buddhism for, I believe, around 15 years. And again, I will try to keep it professional, but I've known this guy too long. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So what have you been doing during this quarantine?
I guess most of us have stopped playing for, gigs for the most part. I'm lucky that I still have quite a busy teaching schedule. So I've been teaching a lot.
Are you still teaching at Manhattan School of Music?
Yeah, still teaching at Manhattan School of Music.
And, so you've been doing it digitally?
Yeah. This whole semester is, for me, is going to basically be online. They do have precautions that they've made at the school where they can, they've even made like masks for the horns now. It's like you have covers for the bells of your horns.
Holy shit.
And you have to be 10 feet apart. But they've made it so I can zoom in to their rehearsal. It'll be like that, cool. So I don't have to go in.
If you do piano stuff, though, like what's your setup? Do you have like an above cam? Do you kind of like...
No, I just have the laptop.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, for most of my students, I'm able to talk to them verbally. It's like they don't need to see it. And if I ever do, yeah, I mean, it's the... Put my phone over my hand if it has to be like that. But for the most part, it can be explained. And you know, one of my teachers from back in the day, Barry Harris, whenever you'd go for a lesson with him, he would show you, he'd play it, but then he'd have you play it, and then after you played it, after you could show that you had it, then he would try to push you into some other things, and it would always be verbal. Nice. It wouldn't be like him showing you and then you playing it. He'd tell you what to do. But besides that, I've been actually writing and composing quite a bit. So I've been spending this time getting my creative juices out with writing. So I've been writing a lot of different stuff. Been writing some jazz stuff, but also a lot of I don't know what you would call it. It's not jazz though.
But it's not pop, is it?
Yeah, it's just top 40.
It's not pop. I mean, for people that really do pop, they would probably say it was. They'd probably say it was jazz.
Exactly.
But it is rock. It's more rock grooves. No, actually, that's not true. I mean, it's not jazz. No, it's definitely not jazz.
It's like as pop as Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, it's more along those lines. Right. Yeah, definitely.
I just love if you don't play a triad, they're just like, oh, that's like jazzy.
We should, exactly right.
I should totally make that. I'm like, yeah,
I could
really
play
jazzy.
You a C chord. I don't know what that seven stuff is.
It's devil's music. That's what it is.
Yeah,
it is.
But I mean, what happens when you have to talk to people about physical things, like when you study with was it Sophia Rossoff? Is that her name? And was she the one that was telling you about relaxing your hands and having this really almost like an Alexander technique approach or something like that?
Well, I don't know enough about Alexander technique to say so, but yeah, she was a remarkable teacher who people from many different instruments and different styles would go to. She had a lot of jazz students, whereas she wasn't a jazz musician at all. But she was a teacher of just how to physically be at the instrument. And she had an approach that I haven't really gotten from anyone else, where she really would make you integrate with the music, in a sense. It was and she would have you do all these, and without it being like kind of fluffy or like new agey, she would have you do these like real exercises where she would be like, all right, you got to put a blindfold on now, mm-hmm. and play the piece. Like I would work on classical music a lot with her, and she'd make you play the piece and without stopping. So she wanted you to make mistakes. It's not that she wanted you to make mistakes, but she wanted you to be able to let go of the mistakes, in a sense. So you'd have to sit there with the blindfold on and play as if the music was happening, and you would keep going even when you made a mistake. And she said that you had to make a mess before you made something beautiful. Things like that. She'd have you balance an egg. That was one of her big things.
Wow.
One of my first lessons, she told me to go in the refrigerator and get an egg. And then she told me to balance it. And because you feel...
And she told you to paint the fence after that and then whack the car.
Yeah, exactly. You might make that analogy there, Adam. It was kind of like the Karate Kid of piano.
I'm into Cobra Kai now, so this is deep.
Jesus.
Have you seen Cobra Kai?
I have not, no.
Oh, it's amazing, man. It's on Netflix.
You got to understand about that show, though, is that it was originally 2 years ago released with YouTube.
I know, no one cares about YouTube.
But, you know, I feel like Netflix is getting all the glory.
What is the show about?
It's them. It's Daniel LaRusso and Johnny, like, now, and with them in it. You know, it's like Ralph Macchio and William Zabka, and like what they're doing now. And Johnny's kind of, you know, down on his luck, and Ralph Macchio has kind of got this car dealership, and like, and then
no way,
it's really nostalgic. Like, if you like that stuff, like, it's totally worth it. Danielle and I blew through the first two seasons, and we're waiting for the third.
Oh, okay. Like, oh, that sounds great.
It's really, really good. Like, you know, in a really cheesy way.
Looking for things to binge on.
Oh, man.
I did Mr. Robot also.
Oh, that's amazing.
Nice. What a great show, huh?
Yeah, and the ending was great.
The ending actually blew me away.
Totally.
And it also kind of sparked an interest with me and my wife to look into DID stuff.
Oh.
About people with DID, and it's pretty remarkable, and I've been integrating thoughts about that with my Zen stuff
about dissociative identity disorder.
Well, because here's the interesting thing about it is that everybody is born with this kind of array of, you know, this kind of like cast of personalities, mm-hmm. right? That at a certain age, you start to integrate them into this one person, you know? And what happens is that when someone receives some kind of trauma or something as a child, before that happens, they stay kind of split. And there was something that rang true about that to me, too. I don't have dissociative identity disorder, but I think that, you know, we all have shit that happens to us when we're younger. That causes, and because I feel like I have some alter egos for sure, you know what I mean? And it made me start to consider what those alter egos are and what it means to integrate.
And how powerful they manifest themselves, maybe. You know, I think on some people, it's just like you have a Jekyll and Hyde when someone drinks, you know, and then others,
right.
And you can't believe it's the same person often, you know. But with DID, the
you
switch
don't know what
gets
the trigger
flipped.
Is going to be.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the United States of Tara. Did you ever get into that show?
No.
It's heavy. It was a really good show. It ended, I believe, but it was a Showtime show, I think. Anyway.
I never made it to the end of Mr. Robot. How many seasons are there? Because I kind of lost track.
Four or five?
Four.
Four?
Right. Yeah, we just finished the last one. My brother, I told my brother,
Yeah,
the last season was so good. And I told my brother, because he was watching along with me and, you know, in his time with his wife. And I was like, did you see the new last season? Because we kind of forgot about it and then caught up. And he says, well, no, I watched season three. And then I watched the spinoff, which was the Queen movie. And then, you know, I was hoping that... You know, and I thought that's what happened. You know, yeah,
just total DID time travel.
Yeah, exactly.
And now he's a villain in the latest Marvel movie.
He's great.
Or Bond, I think. Right,
Bond. That's right. The new Bond movie. Yeah, he's a Bond villain.
That's gonna be crazy.
But all right, so you have been doing Zen Buddhism for a while, or practicing. And I remember when you first started doing it, you were doing all those retreats. And you had this great story about meditating and, you know, something strange happening up there at one of the retreats that was kind of fun.
That was the first retreat that I ever went on. So, you know, a Zen retreat is a very unique thing. I mean, there's nothing really like it, nothing else quite like it. And it has its own name. It's called a Sesshin. And so that was the first Sesshin I ever went to. And there's this... very traditional Japanese monastery up in Livingston, New York, called Daibozatsu Zendo. And that's not the Zendo that I belong to. My family, my Sangha, is called the Village Zendo. But at that time, I was really kind of hungry to do a retreat, and I hadn't done one yet. And I wasn't going to be able to make the times of the Village Zendo retreat. So I started shopping around, and I found this place, and it looked kind of cool. It was like in the middle of the woods, and it looked authentic. And I brought it to my teacher, and she said, yeah. She said, go ahead, check it out. So the thing is that there's like really two avenues of Zen. There's the Rinzai Zen, which is the place that I went to for this retreat. And then there's Soto Zen, which is kind of a little bit more of what my Zendo is. My Zendo is actually a little bit of both. But Soto Zen in general, they call like the way of the farmer. And the Rinzai Zen was like the way of the warrior, kind of. So they're super strict, and they're really kind of super, super intense. I only did one retreat there, and I don't think I'll go back. Just for an example, like the guy was walking around, like they come around with this stick, and they'll hit you with it if you want to get hit with the stick. You ask for it, you put your hands in the prayer position, and you bow, and then you would turn your head, and the guy would smack you in the shoulder. And it actually could feel nice, like, because you get a little stiff. So this guy was walking down with the stick, and I literally just tilted my head a little bit this way to see how stiff my neck was. And he screamed as loud as he could, "Sit still!" So I wasn't sure if that place was going to be for me, but during the day you wake up at the crack of dawn, and then at this place they only had two breaks throughout the day for an hour, and it was next to a lake. And I would go down, there was this nice big rock next to this lake, and I would go down and like lie on this rock and contemplate whatever. And one of the things that these monks and students at this center would do is they'd practice mu, which is comes from like one the most famous Zen koan is, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And the guy says mu, which kind of means no, but it's more than that. And so these guys would walk into the woods and scream moo at the top of their lungs. And so I'd sit there on this rock, you know, on a beautiful day, listening to these guys. And every now and then I'd hear them walking by in the grass. And I remember I was contemplating oneness, because I'd heard people talking about how it, we're all one and it's, and everything is one. And I was sitting there just trying to make sense out of that. And I heard somebody walking by, but this time the person didn't, continue to walk by. They were like walking around still, just in the grass. And so I got up and turned around, and sure enough, about 5 to 10 feet away from me was this big black bear. and I it was just completely instinct. I just jumped up on the rock and I stood straight up and I was looking the bear right in the eyes. And the bear was grazing a little bit, and it looked up and caught my eyes for a split second, and then it was gone. And that thing could run.
Yeah,
I could not believe how fast it ran. It is a very, very fast animal.
It's better that it ran, though. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I'm lucky that it ran.
But that, it's like the funny thing of, you know, people tell you, like, don't run if you see a bear. And it's like, why the hell not? Of course I'm going to run. Because it'll fucking catch you. That's why. Like, yes. It's way faster than you are. That's
it's
why.
Way faster than you think.
If you see Carl Lewis, don't fucking run away from him, because he's going to fucking catch you.
There you go. That's right.
It's like, shit, man.
I don't think Carl Lewis or Usain Bolt could outrun a bear, man.
No.
And if they grab
they can outrun me.
Yeah. Then you're like Leonardo DiCaprio in that movie.
Oh, shit.
And so that was it. So then I was hooked.
So as far as Zen Buddhism and your practice, how has that affected you or helped you during quarantine? I mean, do you do daily meditations, breathing exercises? Like, what do you incorporate?
It's not breathing exercises, but yeah, meditation. You know, my Zendo has also gone virtual. So there's usually two meetings a day where you can go and meditate on Zoom. And so I've been doing it every morning with them from 7:30 to 8:30. And I didn't start doing that. So, you know, during this time, my schedule is kind of flipped a little bit. You know, I used to be the typical jazz musician up until 3-4 in the morning. But then that started to change with this. There was no reason to stay up late in the morning. I was starting to like the mornings. And I have to say, it made a huge, huge difference. The before and after. Before, I was meditating in the mornings, and then after. I mean, just from the amount of natural anxiety that's coming up for everybody right now.
So you're saying the time of meditation is making a big difference for you, or
no,
just doing it at all?
Just doing it, yeah, yeah. I wasn't sitting for an hour. I wasn't doing it. You know, for me, my kind of pillar was always the center. So I was always making sure that I was there. I didn't have the strongest home practice per se, and this has kind of got me on this like super strong home practice, and which has been kind of. I don't know where I would be without it right now with everything that's going on.
Yeah,
you know, my wife had to stop working for a lot of time.
Oh shit!
And I wasn't doing gigs, so we were all home all the time, and you know, gotta fill that time up with something, you know. And it's, if nothing else, the boredom could get intense, you know. So. The practicing in the morning is just, you know, there's something about if you ever experience anxiety, it's not just a mental experience, you know, it's a real physical experience. So it's like you feel it all throughout your body, and you feel it. I feel it in my gut too a lot of times when it happens, chest area, and it's like when you sit and you meditate, you know, a lot of the reason why that's happening is because we're tensing parts of our body kind of unconsciously. So once you sit and start to breathe and follow your breath, you start to release those areas, and it completely can alleviate anxiety sometimes.
Wow. I think that's why like the blindfold make a mistake thing helps too, because like when you make mistakes, you go tense, and then you're physically messing up everything that you just worked for, you know? So that's kind of what I was thinking about with meditation though. Like what's the, you still use breathing to sort of go in to like meditation, right? Like what are basic differences between a more breathing type of meditation?
Mine was mantra based. I mean, Jeremy's would be different than that, Zen meditation, right?
Yeah.
Yours was what?
It was mantra based. It was Indian, you know?
Yeah.
But it's, that's a little different, but it's,
yeah,
I don't know. I don't know about Buddhist meditation.
Well, I mean, I think there's different types of meditation within Buddhism also, right? The Tibetan Buddhists have different ways of meditating. And, you know, from what I understand, there's kind of three main kind of elements to all Buddhist practice. There's meditation, there's chanting, and there's study. And different traditions give different weight to each one of those. So, like for example, the Nichiren Buddhists who chant Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, the chanting is the most important part. You know, in Tibetan Buddhism, I know that study is a very big part. Like they study all the different sutras and everything. So in Zen, it's meditation is the highest part, and it's, meditation is the most important element. And from there, everything kind of falls underneath that. There is study, and there is some chanting, but it's a lot more watered down. But the meditation itself is based on following the breath.
All right.
The breath is always the breath is like your mantra in a sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's your life force.
Yeah. It's always what's happening right now.
Yeah.
Also, which is what you're trying to do. It's like it's not that you're trying to stop thinking.
That's why it's so helpful. And that's why it's so helpful for like people with high anxiety, because all you really have to do is just start paying it, like put all that anxiety and point it towards your breath, mm-hmm. and it'll literally just heal you.
And from what I understand, there are India. I mean, I never did pranayama, but that is breath work from, you know, India as well. So I mean, a lot of different cultures do different things with that. But yeah, what I did was purely mantra based. Although by the time you do that, you notice that your breath falls in line and all those things. So mm-hmm. as long as you get there somehow, right?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's many ways to get there. There's not one way.
And I found that, I think what you said was right on. I mean, I've been out of practice for a while, and, you know, there's so many things that creep into your subconscious that when you do meditate, if you haven't for a while and you're used to it, you realize how restless your mind is. And it's immediately apparent after just sitting for like 15 minutes, you know, and you start to realize, shit, I should be doing this much more often, because we don't get a break. You know, you just wake up and you're powering through, and all this stuff's happening outside and on the news, and it's impossible not to have it seep into you.
Do you like ask yourself at the end of it, like to remember like that feeling? Because I think that's important, because then you know you want to get back to it.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I don't need to ask myself that anymore, because it's you know, I feel like there is this sometimes a battle between our head and our body, right? Or mind and heart, however you want to look at that. But I think that once we really experience something and really have that physical memory of that experience, then that's for me, that's where the faith element, if there is one, in Zen came from. And it's from, you know, It's really scary the evening before a retreat. It's always pretty intense, because you're going to be in silence for a week. You're going to be meditating, I don't know, between 6 and 9 hours a day, depending on where, you know, what the retreat is. You know, there's different schedules, but it's intense. You know. It's super intense, but there is something in me that I know that once I get to that second or third day, something kind of like happens. I don't know what else to say. There's like a place that you can touch after doing that for a few days, and I trust that, you know. So that's why I do keep going back to these retreats. The retreats for me have been extremely, extremely beneficial.
Nice.
Really have helped my life a lot. And the other thing I've been doing lately has been writing in a book, just like writing, like you're talking about formulating thoughts and stuff. I think that's the other way. So, because it's like, on one hand, you want to try to like kind of calm your mind and just let the thoughts come and go. But then another sense, you do want to kind of figure out what your thought process is, what, you know, the things that you're, the things well, that are running through your mind.
You're letting it pass by, but then you get to actually like dive into it and be like, maybe there's something in there.
Exactly.
And you have it written. So it's like, oh shit, you know, I mean, it's basically, you know, stuff. It's dreams essentially. But you have a written account of it. I mean, that's, your head's just going crazy.
And, you know, speaking of dreams, going back to that DID thing for a second, there's this one, there's a few people that have YouTube channels where you meet their alters. You meet their other personalities. Wow. And they, and this, and in this one, they explain how they actually built an island where they all live when the host is in charge.
Wow.
So, I mean, but just like, I mean, our minds, think about how powerful our minds are, that you can do that, that these people, that when they're speaking, it's an actual person. It's like this woman, but, you know, her author at this point is Daniel.
Yeah.
And she's acting like a guy, you know, and he's telling about the island. And, yeah, I got this hut over here, and I live next to Steven, and then Mary's
right
down the road.
They all hang out.
You know? It's kind of, it's amazing. I mean, and they spend, and that's her whole life, they've done that. You know, it's pretty remarkable what we can do with our minds.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, you know, you can definitely do it unconsciously, that's for sure. So if you can bring that to your conscious, I mean, when we dream, it's absolutely bonkers. You know what I mean? Your mind.
Right.
And that's just because your body is asleep, you know. Imagine if you can pull that forward.
Yeah.
And it's funny what you said about, to like what you're saying before. So you're saying the 3 days of this retreat of not talking, you know, after the third day or so, you kind of snap into this different place. And I think there's a parallel with that in fasting as well. I know that I've done like the master cleanse. I've done all that stuff, you know, and your body, for no matter what it is, I swear, it's like quitting coffee, you're like doing anything. It's like, I think day three is the day where you finally start to like hit this peak of like acceptance. I don't know why it always seems like it's exactly 3 days. And maybe it doesn't correlate to what you're saying, but something.
I mean, I think it's just survival. It's millions of years of evolution in,
like,
in
to
your
learn a new skill.
Survival.
Yeah. You can't learn in a day, you know. That's for
sure.
Well,
you just know that you're like, okay, we're in this for like a long run, so I'm gonna put the body on like battle station, you know, and we'll get through this shit.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like, your body can accept and adapt.
Yeah.
If it's, I mean, we've been around for so long, you know. But I wouldn't be able to pass the fourth day silent retreat. You know, they test you, they play a bass solo. And if you don't talk during it, then, you know,
it's just not even
reached,
funny at all.
You've reached Zen.
there's a funny story about these three young monks that are going to do a silent. They're taking a vow of silence together, the three of them. And they're sitting there in meditation on the first night. And an attendant, I guess from the monastery or whatever, walks in the room. And one of the monks asks the attendant to put out the candle. And the second monk turns to him and says, "You idiot, we're not supposed to talk." And then the third monk says, "I'm the only one who has not yet spoken."
Jesus.
So you're allowed to text? Can you get around the vow of silence?
Oh my God, yeah. That's the way it is now. But you know, the funny thing is, you know, in the Zendo that I am, I kind of, I hold some positions. So like when we go on retreats now, I help organize it. And I'm one of the people that communicate with the people that organize it. So, and the way we communicate is with text.
Yeah.
So yes, text is a modern Zen technique of communication.
So how do you feel that your practice of Buddhism has directly affected your music or just your meditation? And do you think about that while you're practicing or performing? Do you do any meditation before you play? It's kind of a lot of questions, but like, how does this integrate into your music?
I guess in a bunch of ways, you know, the interesting thing is, I think that as musicians, we all have basically meditated in a sense. You know, it's like practicing your instrument is basically a form of meditation.
Yeah, I'd say so.
And it's also called a practice. You know, it's called a meditation practice. And so as musicians, we also get the concept of practice. You know, we know what that means. We know that it means that you have to actually get your ass on that seat or wherever it is that you need to do it. So I think I realized that I had been meditating for a while already, and I used to, before I really was meditating, I used to do that. I used to do a kind of, I guess an awareness type of meditation, you know, before I would practice, to kind of just kind of settle me down. But then I just kind of, it's become more of an integrated thing. And, you know, when I play, I think when you play, I'm trying to stay as present as, you know, as I can. And that's really the biggest lesson that meditation teaches us, is to really be here, to be here right now. You know, especially as an improvising musician, I mean, that's really, I mean, to be honest, I don't know if there's a real difference between, you know, besides lifestyle, between some of these, you know, master musicians that we know and a Zen master. I mean, it's a lot of Zen masters have been alcoholics too.
right.
You know,
I think people have the misconception that someone's completely pure, like the Dalai Lama or something.
Completely,
like that.
Yeah, totally. And it's different. It's a culturally different thing too.
Right.
You know, alcohol and things like that are looked differently in different countries.
Right.
But you know, it's mostly been a. Well, you know what? To be honest, I think that a big part of it, the main part that it helped was with my own kind of self-criticism, and my own kind of like inner critic, you know. And I guess what meditation like taught me or helped me kind of realize that was just some kind of imaginary voice that I didn't need to listen to, and it was, you know, it's kind of like the end of I relate this a lot. The end of A Beautiful Mind. You ever see that movie with Russell Crowe?
Yeah, sure.
And he had something like DID.
Schizophrenia.
But he had these alternate. And at the end of the movie, once he kind of gets himself together and he realized everything, those characters are still walking with him. They're still there. It's not like they've left. But they're not talking to him anymore. They're not distracting him anymore. You know, and that's and that's kind of what Zen and meditation has helped, like all those like kind of neuroses and those things that we have that kind of can hold us back as musicians. It kind of helped in the same way, where it's like, oh, that stuff is still there. I mean, it's like, I still have my shit. I still have my issues, but I don't really care about them too much anymore. And they don't have as loud of a voice.
Yeah, they don't rule
in
you.
My head. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, man, I could see that. I mean, you've still been like teaching a lot, like you said, and you have a ton of students, and you're a great teacher. You know, for those of you who don't know, Jeremy's got some really great videos on My Music Masterclass, and we have heard nothing but praise, you know, from all kinds of people that just love how you teach, you know. And what is your connection to the student like when you get together teaching? Because you're such a natural teacher. Like, I know when you do videos, you're teaching to a camera, you know, more general. But when you're in a room with someone, do you, you know, how do you get to know what they really need? Or is that too broad of a question?
No, it's not too broad of a question. I mean, I'll tell you first that I kind of knew that I wanted to be a teacher when I was in high school. I first got this inclination, and I had this great teacher named Justin DiCiocio, and it was kind of an accident that I got put into his class, because I was a piano player at LaGuardia High School, and if you're a piano player or a guitar player, you had to choose a secondary instrument, so you could play in a concert band or an orchestra or something like that. And so I thought I wanted to play a saxophone, so I put down saxophone. And then what that meant was that they threw me into the woodwinds class, where I was able to choose between oboe and bassoon. So I played oboe for a year, and I hated it.
I'd pick oboe, definitely.
Well, it was a smaller case. I didn't want to carry the bassoon case home. But so I hated it. So the next year I asked if I could switch out, and I ended up playing double bass for the remainder of high school.
Nice.
But that opened up a hole in my schedule, so they just threw me into Justin's jazz history class. And I remember the very first class, it was something about Louis Armstrong. And it might have been West End Blues or I forget. It was one of these kind of iconic pop solos. And he kind of acted it while it was playing. Like he came running into the room like he was a knight with like a sword. And there was something so inspirational about that. I don't know. There was something about that that it was like seeing that I was able to kind of experience the music differently. You know, it really like kind of gave
Justin
me something.
Justin always had that kind of energy, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and,
totally.
And enthusiasm towards teaching, which Absolutely. Not a lot of people have.
Yeah.
When I was at Manhattan School of Music, he was there as well. And he wasn't the department head at that point. It was Dick Lowenthal. But his enthusiasm was just, you know, some of my teachers were less than thrilled to be there. And he was always seemed, you know, he had a lot to give.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So that put a huge mark on me, and it was also my introduction to jazz at the same time.
Oh, really?
That was it. I mean, I was in that class with Stephen Scott, great piano player. And I remember when he asked, the very first time he asked Stephen if he'd play an example of something. And Stephen played something on the piano, and then Justin explained afterwards that he was just improvising. And I was just like, you know,
was Eric
like
McPherson in that class too?
No, he was in my class. So I was a sophomore that was put into the senior class because I had a hole in my schedule. I ended up taking it again when I was a senior. So Eric was my year. So I think we were both in it when we were seniors.
Yeah.
But so that really was the first thing that kind of like inspired me to want to teach. But so let me see, try to dissect your question from before again.
Well, let's make this question slightly easier. When you're teaching college level nowadays at Manhattan School of Music, not for prep, what are things that you most find that people need to work on? That seems like a more doable thing.
That's a wide question, because it's really different. It's really different for everybody, and I really feel like we're in a very really transitional time, and things are changing. And to be honest, you know, it's like I try to humble myself to that, because I know I'm from an older generation now, you know, and I came up in the '90s when it was like a kind of a resurgence of classic jazz kind of scene, and also aesthetic and vibe. So I'm open to what they have, you know. I'm trying to give them some history, you know. I'm always trying to do what Dizzy said and keep a foot in the past and a foot in the present. But mostly like what I try to do, because in many ways I found music to be a struggle, like learning music, especially in college, and learning about some of these harmonic concepts and techniques. And what I've done is I've tried to find a way to kind of explain it better than it was explained to me in a way that really makes sense in a kind of integral experiential way, as opposed to just a theoretical understanding of it, right?
Yeah. And do you have different ways to explain the same thing in case someone doesn't resonate with a certain idea?
Well, I mean, I hope so. I mean, that's part of being an improviser too, you know, which is why, Ingrid Jensen, great trumpet player, just took over as the interim head of the jazz department. And she said that to me.
Nice.
She said, thank God we're jazz musicians, huh? For teaching this, you know, because we're used to improvising. We're used to flying by the seat of our pants. So I have different ways to explain it, but I try to break it down, and I always try to make it something that's experienced and like kind of felt, as opposed to just understood, because we all know that you can understand something, but you can't, that doesn't mean you can play it.
Right.
You know, and it's better to play, to be able to play something and not understand it, than it is to understand it and not be able to play it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these great cats were like that, you know. I mean,
there's plenty.
I did a session with someone I don't want to name, but like big time, like super like star, big star in a sense. And it was like, there was something that he couldn't get and it was on the page, but it was like, he wasn't feeling it. So because he wasn't feeling it, he wasn't going to play it.
Yeah.
If it made sense. It was like, it didn't matter if he could count and make sense of it on the part. It was like, he wasn't integrating it. It wasn't part of his body. So he wasn't going to play it.
Right.
You know, and I thought that was amazing, actually.
Yeah, that is, man. Yeah, I love that stuff. We were just talking to Pete Bernstein was on the podcast just a couple episodes ago, and we were talking about the life lessons you learn from older musicians, and if you have your ears open, there's some wise shit going on. I tell you.
Oh, yeah.
He was telling me some Sonny Rollins stories, and you know, it's there if you have your ears open, they'll tell you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And sometimes it doesn't come in the normal way. You know, it's not going to come in a way that's theoretical all the time, or a way that makes sense to you in a music school way. But you have to get the message.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't know anyone else who's going to have better stories than him.
No.
I mean, the people he's had the pleasure of playing with. Yeah. But I did start to learn about that when I started going to Barry Harris, because, you know, I was a finely polished, student, you know, with a degree now. And I started going to Barry, and he didn't talk about things the way they do in the conservatory. You know, he talked about it differently. And you had to be able to understand what he was saying. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about music the way I think cats back in the day did, a little bit more too. And so you start to see that there's a lot of different ways that you can call something, you know.
Yeah.
But the actual experience and sound of it is going to be the same. So it doesn't, you know, there's so many ways to look at it. And mm-hmm. and it's just 12 notes, right? It's just 12 notes. It's just like there's been so many people trying to make sense out of these damn 12 notes for so long time.
Still working on it.
You know?
Now we've distilled it to like 3 notes in auto-tune, so it's a little easier.
Exactly.
And 3 producers. You know, we're just trying to make less options, you know, make it easier.
You know, the funny thing is like in class now, like I remember before we were going remote, I teach an improv class at the school too, and so put all this stuff on the board, and I asked them to take it down for notes. And instead of taking out their books, they take out their phones and they snap a picture of it.
You little shits.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Tell them they got to learn. You got to learn how to use the pencil. You got to learn how to write things out with your hand. I think it's really important. You know, it's good to do both. I'm not saying that you don't kind of have your Sibelius or whatever chops together. But.
And a current note, have you been doing any of these recordings online, or have you tried to do any, are you going to try to record any of your new compositions?
I've been going crazy with Logic. I got Logic, and so I've I don't know how many I have now. I think I have about seven or eight tunes.
Oh, nice, man.
Yeah, on Logic, and then I have a whole basically another jazz record ready to go of tunes. And I've just been really, really focusing on simplicity. That's really, like, I think maybe that's a sign of age too. Like, the older we get, the more we realize we don't know. So we try to get it simpler. And, you know, I remember going to see Barry. You know, he's one of these. And, you know, Barry was, by the way, he was a student of Sophia.
Oh, really?
Yeah, crazy. Barry was a student of Sophia for like 30 years.
Love it.
And Sophia was a student of this woman named Abby Whiteside,
right?
Who wrote this amazing book called The Indispensables of Piano Playing. And she was the one, I guess, where all this came from. And she had 2 students, another Russian guy who died in, I think, the 80s, and then Sophia, who just passed away about 2 or 3 years ago. And Barry, so there's a series of concerts that they do every year at the Weill Recital Hall at Carnegie, the piano hall that's up on the 3rd floor, for the Abby Whiteside Foundation. And so far I got Barry to do one of them. And it's, you know, it's just a pristine piano room. It's just amazing. And I don't know how he does it. But he's the only person I've ever heard that would get up there, and I swear to you, he played one note, and I didn't know how the hell he played that note like that. It was amazing. It was like something fell out of the sky. It was just astounding. His touch is something.
Yeah, it's crazy, right?
Something special, and a lot of that came from Sophia, that he's still able to play. You know, he's really getting up there now, so he can't play fast like he used to. But you know, he played a lot longer than you're supposed to because he never developed any kind of arthritis or carpal tunnel, anything, you know, which a lot of people would go to Sophia with.
You know, it's one of those things that I think I've talked to other pianists about this too. It's that, you know, with guitar, people always talk about tone, and with, you know, certain instruments that they feel like you touch, and they don't realize that piano is really a string instrument, you know, and it's, and it has a lot to do with, if you just hit the key, you know, it's not like if I can hit my MIDI controller and it might be like on or off, like it's a one and a zero, binary code, you know, they might have different pressure sensitivity levels, but it's not the same as you can get a lot of different tones from a piano. I'm not a pianist, but I know it for sure.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And you can tell people's sounds, right? It's crazy.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Right, because all those, think
across
of all those
different
Rudy
pianos.
Van Gelder. Yeah, think of all those Rudy Van Gelder records. They're all the same piano.
True.
You know?
Exactly.
Actually, I just got to play that, you know, because that studio is still there.
Yeah, Ian, Ian's record, right?
No, I did. It was a solo thing. Don Sickler put together this project for all these unrecorded Herbie Nichols compositions.
No way.
And he got I think he got 20 piano players, something like that, and gave us each a tune to learn and to do a solo record in the old Van Gelder studio.
Oh, man.
On that piano.
Is it solo piano? So,
it's solo piano, yeah.
Oh,
it didn't come out. I did this literally last December, right before this, at the Fan. So,
but I bet the piano sounds nice.
Piano sounds great, yeah.
And it must have been just super crazy being in there.
Yeah, it was pretty nuts. Yeah.
You feel the vibes that coming out of the walls.
Hallowed ground, yeah. It's like playing at the Vanguard, same thing.
Yeah.
It's like, damn, fucking Coltrane recording in this room. I'm like, whoa.
Exactly.
Yeah, Jesus.
Yeah. But man, thanks so much, Jeremy. We should, you know, get in touch more. We should hang more often, but I mean, it's, you know, obviously we can't, and you know, I'll see you soon.
It's like my man Jimmy Dore at the end of his videos now, he goes, now's the time when I would usually tell everybody to leave a donation, but nobody has a job, or I tell you to come out to my show, but nobody can go out, so just watch the next video.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. All right. Yeah, great seeing you. See you. Well, you know, I hope
we should hang out, but we can't. So
yeah, and I hope the Yankees win this minor league rules season. But
let's see what happens. It's kind of crazy, right? It's wild.
Exactly. Wild. Except the Rays will probably win because, you know, they are. The
Oakland's looking pretty good too, huh?
I know.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
They're up at the top right now.
But, you know, we got the baby bombers if they decide to play.
I know, but what's the deal with everybody getting hurt every season?
What is the deal with that?
That's
what's
the craziest
deal
thing, right?
With everyone getting hurt? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why everyone's hurt, man. They fired the entire medical staff last year, and now
Jesus, back to still hasn't helped,
it
right?
No, I mean, it hasn't helped. I mean, Judge and Stanton are injury prone, but Glaber he's hurt. LeMay was already hurt.
Yeah,
Paxton's a nightmare. You know,
he's also going to be like that, I think.
Yeah,
but God, is there going to be one season when Judge plays the whole year?
Only his first year. I mean, and I think he was out for a little bit.
He was out for a little bit that year, too. Yeah.
I don't think so.
That's what all those sirens are for. They're just going to pick up all the players.
They're just picking up.
Now they're trying to turn the game right now.
You should have heard it when, you remember when that big, whatever that was, military ship came in?
Yeah.
That they turned into a hospital?
Yeah.
It was literally sirens all day. Because that was right. Because they had the Javits Center. It was just south of me.
Yeah, you're
and there was a hospital. They turned that into a hospital, and then that ship was just north of me. So it was just like in April and May, it was just like constant
sirens.
Hence
the chronic meditation.
Yes, exactly.
It was like, well, you know, the truth is, if I didn't meditate, I'd have to, you know, start IV drug use again.
We all hear sirens in our head all the time. Exactly.
Fuck. All right, man. Well, it was great seeing you.
Dude, and, thanks, man.
We'll
great
talk
seeing
again
you.
Soon.
Yeah, man.
All right, cool. Brother.
Peace. All right, man. Later.
See ya.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail, you can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformancepathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes. So, look forward to hearing from you.